good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cedarstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. And my co-host today is going to be James Corbett. Yes, the second and third segment today, I am pleased to have this conversation with him. It was previously recorded on Wednesday evening, so I am live the first 20 minutes for today, which is Friday, February 8th, 2019. So let's go ahead and get started right away. You know, I have that opening so memorized. I was thinking I had a co-host today, and but kind of we do with James Corbett, and it was a different interview than we normally have. We talk about science, a little bit about science and a little bit about socialism, and so make sure you stay tuned as we get through the market report for, once again, February 8th, 2019. And gold today, you know, it's still staying there above that 1315 for gold, up $4.30. Silver was up 9 pennies today at $15.90. Platinum was up 2 at 804. I don't know, palladium, you know, it's just the big boys playing, and you know, they're just moving that price, and it's $1,410, up $20 today, up 1.5%, and for palladium. USDX today was up stronger by 0.10 at 96.67, and crude oil was up by 0.05 at 52.69. Paper markets today, there was pressure on them, but they really came back in the last hour of trade. The Dow was still down 63 points at 25,106. The NASDAQ was up 10. At 7,298, and the S&P was up 1 at 2,707. The U.S. The 10-year yield was 2.63%. That continues to drop 0.02. And let's see, Japan got whacked last night a little over 2%. European markets, Germany was down 1. Everything else was, pretty much almost about the same, not a lot of action. And there's a couple of things we're going to talk about today. And some of the mainstream media programs, I mean, all they did this morning was talk about Jeff Bezos and the connection between, between Donald Trump and Bezos is claiming blackmail with the Enquirer, which we all know. And it's just like, you know, no one really cares what happens to Jeff Bezos, you know, in his personal life. I mean, certainly if there was issues that, but hey, this goes on all the time. I mean, this isn't new. He just happens to be the richest man in the world. And I don't think you really mess with the richest man in the world. But he's decided to come back and claim that the owner of the National Enquirer that is led by David Pecker, AMI, and I didn't know that they entered into an immunity deal with the Department of Justice related to their role in the catch and kill process on behalf of President Trump and his election campaign. So there are a lot of things that are going on, and I thought that was really interesting that how a newspaper would reach an immunity deal. And but anyway, the saga continues, ladies and gentlemen. And but that was the big headlines of the day, big print everywhere, and we'll have to see how it plays out. Does it have anything to do, and unless they really have some proof that there is a true connection between the Enquirer and the backing of President Trump, I don't think it really is going to make a difference, how it turns out as far as President Trump. But again, it's they're looking under every rock to find something, and I certainly wouldn't want to mess with the richest man in the world. So with that said, there's a lot of people out there who think they're rich. Sure, you know, debt is a favorite topic of mine. And consumer borrowing rose at it did rise at a slower pace in December. It shows you that they might be cutting back. And of course, everybody will say it was because people were anticipating the government shutdown. But that still pushed total borrowing to a new record, $4 trillion for the first time. This report came out yesterday by the Federal Reserve that the borrowing increased by $16 billion in December after a $22 billion advance in November. I can see that. You probably had people doing more shopping in November with Black Friday and, you know, everything else that goes on, trying to pump up sales for the holidays to get these retailers some money so they can stay in business. And so I can see that November would have a bigger increase. So that was where most of your holiday shopping was done. The December increase nudged the total up to a record $4.01 trillion. We crossed the $3 trillion mark back in 2013. Borrowing in the category that includes credit cards rose by $1.7 billion in December, down from $4.8 billion November's increase. That's a big drop. Borrowing in the category that covers auto loans and student loans rose by $4.8 billion. And that followed the larger $17.6 billion gain the previous month. Those are some hefty drops. And analysts, I can't imagine that, $3 billion difference from one month to the next was all due to the holidays, but I suppose. But again, because of the government shutdown, they're not going to release any of these numbers. And now you know why, ladies and gentlemen. They don't want you to know. They don't want you to know that these numbers dropped. And the only reason you're getting these numbers is because it was released by the Federal Reserve. They weren't shut down. So again, it's, hey, take advantage. And you know what? I'm not going to say that's why the government was initially shut down, but I said from a long time, it's just a distraction. It's just a distraction from everything, and maybe it was. Consumer borrowing, of course, is closely watched for clues that it can provide on consumer spending. And of course, we all know that consumer spending accounts for 70% of our economy. The government's report on overall economic growth as measured by GDP, gross domestic product, that has been delayed because of the shutdown. And private economists believe GDP growth slowed to around 2.5%. And again, these numbers, they don't want you to know. They don't want people. Of course, mainstream media wouldn't talk about it anyway. You know, because it's reality, it's the truth. It's not gloom and doom, it's truth. And if you view truth that way, well, it's too bad, because that's what we talk about here. You know, so they're looking at a 2.5% GDP for the fourth quarter, and they expect growth to slow even more in this first quarter of 2019. Now, the Fed monthly borrowing report did not cover home mortgages or any other loans secured by real estate, like home equity loans. So, you know, again, it just goes to show you just how deep in debt people are becoming. And yet we've hit that, you know, we went over $4 trillion with people cutting back in the last quarter. So that's pretty incredible. And hey, if they need money and they can't pay their bills, they ought to go to Chicago. Yeah. They're planning, you know, we've probably talked about this before. There's so many cities now that are looking to basic income, universal basic income for the people of the cities. This is just another city looking to do so, but they're going even further. It really is incredible. They want to pay 1,000 residents $1,000 a month, and of course, no strings attached. And this was pitched by a panel. And again, ladies and gentlemen, this isn't good for Chicago. This is only good for the politicians to get reelected. That's what it's all about, reelection, control. It's not good for the people of Chicago. But $1,000, no strings attached. Pack up your bags and move to Chicago and just make sure that you wear a bulletproof vest or... so you can be safe while you're getting your $1,000 so you can spend it. Anyway, that's another story. But so this is trailblazing pilot. Days after choosing political retirement over the uphill battle for the third term, you have Mayor Rahm Emanuel is asking retired Alderman Amir Pawar something like that, who has championed the cause of income inequality and to chair a task force to consider this universal basic income in Chicago. On Thursday, the task force, so called by SEIU, the local one, President Tom Balanoff and Selena Rolden, CEO of the American Red Cross of Chicago and Northern Illinois, propose a path forward. Now, this 50-page report proposes that Chicago forge ahead by giving the people, as I said, 1,000 people, $1,000, adds up to $12 million a year, to be bankrolled by an unspecified mix of funds. The selection process and eligibility requirements would be left to the new mayor and the city council. But the task force recommends a citywide program not concentrated in any one geographic area or in any one age, racial, or ethnic group. And the pilot could also be open to individuals and families to help seniors, quote, unquote, this article, age in place. Age in place for seniors, that means allowing them to stay in their home. Well, why don't you just remove property tax from them? I'll bet they'll do a lot in order to help senior citizens stay in their home so they can age in place. And they're also looking for this pilot program to help young people who were waiting longer to get married and have children, that would help them. So I don't know if that would help them or not, but that's what they're saying. The task force also recommended expanding the earned income tax credit. Chicago should also consider creating its own version of the earned income credit and explore a broad suite of policies and complementary actions. Let's get back to some of this other good stuff. But the cornerstone is the guaranteed income pilot. They're looking to, of course, gradually raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. Let's see, where did I see? They want people to be able to buy, give them shares into the water fund, the water system. They plan to sell or give away shares in Chicago's water system to city residents and pay them dividends. Kind of like Alaska. You know, the residents benefit from their state's oil. And you have to live there and so forth and whatnot. But, you know, and hey, when oil prices are down, they don't get paid as much and so forth. So it does fluctuate. So that's what they're thinking. It's like this world truly is becoming insane. It really is. And it's so we'll have to see what their little council comes up with and see. And Chicago would actually be the biggest city in the world to test this kind of idea. And so Home Depot is not my favorite. I prefer Lowe's, but Home Depot is laying off employees across the U.S. They confirmed this on Thursday. It was first reported that the move would exclusively affect exterior installation employees at the home improvement chain, and it's only going to affect fewer than 1,000 people. The website, Home Depot's website, describes its installation services team as consisting of professional installers who work in partnership with the company. The blurb also said the team had a critical role within home services and required talent with top-notch skills and a drive for quality and customer service, blah, blah, blah on that. And so they're looking to lay off 1,000 people. And here I thought was interesting, and I have to say kudos to President Trump if this gets done. There is a move to withdraw the and I have to apologize because I wasn't familiar with this. A move to withdraw the Generalized System of Preferences from India. We'll call it GSP. India is the world's largest beneficiary of a scheme that has been enforced since the 1970s. And this would be the strongest punitive action against India since President Trump took office in 2017, vowing to reduce the U.S. deficit with large economies. President Trump has repeatedly called out India for its high tariffs. India Prime Minister Modi has courted foreign investment as part of his Make in a India campaign to turn India into a manufacturing hub and deliver jobs to the millions of youth entering the workforce. And President Trump, for his part, has pushed for, of course, U.S. manufacturing to return home as part of this. And so it is the GSP was tied to the trade package, and since the deal had slipped further away, the United States was considering withdrawing or scaling back the preferential arrangement, people familiar with the matter said. So India and the United States have developed close political and security ties, but bilateral trade, which stood at $126 billion in 2017, is widely seen to be performing at nearly a quarter of its potential. U.S. Secretary Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross is due in New Delhi next week, and he's expected to raise concerns about the e-commerce policy and data localization. And again, this you know, we'll have to see. I mean, bringing it up and talking about it doesn't mean that you know, they're going to get away with zero tariffs, but we'll have to see how that furthers along. And as I said, the news gets wackier and wackier, and I always liked Jerome Corsi. You know, I really think he's an honest guy. And he filed a lawsuit on Roger Stone yesterday for defamation. The lawsuit filed in the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia by Corsi is seeking $25 million in damages, alleges Stone lied and threatened Corsi as both men tried to distance themselves from the allegations they had prior knowledge of WikiLeaks. The lawsuit compares Stone's behavior to that of a member of mafia. The lawsuit claims Stone's intentional infliction of emotional distress, coercion, and threats are intended to try even cause Corsi to have heart attacks and strokes. Corsi also claims Stone's conduct caused him conscious pain, suffering, severe emotional distress, and the fear of imminent serious bodily injury or death. And the lawsuit goes on. And there was even one point in the lawsuit that he talks about Stone was accused of threatening the dog, a radio host, Randy Credico. So, I don't know, ladies and gentlemen. You know, I always liked to, but that's what happens when you hang around folks like Roger Stone. And I want you guys to hang around with us because we're good. We tell you the truth. And I'll be back with James Corbett here in just a few short minutes. We will find you acting on your bed.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. TalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Financial Survival brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. And I'm pleased to welcome back to the program James Corbett. And of course, you know, James is the founder and editor of the Corbett Report. And you can go to that website, thecorbettreport.com. And James also became the editorial writer for the International Forecaster that was created by economic analyst Bob Chapman. And of course, if you would like a complimentary issue of the International Forecaster, please go to their website, theinternationalforecaster.com. And hello, James.
Well, hello. Thank you for having me back on. It's a pleasure to be here again.
Oh, I love this hour. I love this hour with you. And I have a simple question. What's new?
Good question. All right. Well, I'll give you a multiple choice answer if you want.
Okay.
Okay. So, one of the multiple choice answers is that contrary to all of my inclinations to dismiss and ignore to the extent possible the political back and forth caterwauling nonsense that populates the newsfeed like so much excess dryer lint, I actually paid attention enough to the headlines about the State of the Union address by the president to actually pick up on something from that speech that I'm going to be writing about in the International Forecaster this weekend. So that would be one of the options.
Are you going another to option? Give us a little bit of a hint.
Well, if you want to go straight into that one, we can go into that.
Okay. Well, what's your number two?
Number two, I'm going in the near future. I'm going to be talking about the crisis of science, including replication, irreproducibility of reports, which is a word that I think I'm going to have to practice between now and the time I actually record the report, and other things that are calling into question the scientism, which unfortunately has affected the population in recent decades. Experts say, scientists warn, etc., etc. And the third possibility for what's new would be reports about China and its ongoing police state high-tech crime-fighting crackdown, including its AI, what's touted as an AI-powered crime-fighting system like Skynet and other such things, like literally called Skynet. I'm not making a Terminator reference. That is apparently being not utilized to its full, is being turned off because it may be a little too effective in catching some of the crooks in Chinese government. So those are your one, two, three options. You tell me which one you pick.
Well, I did have some questions about the Chinese dragon that you recently wrote about. So we'll skip that one. And now I have a choice between the state and the... Let's start with the crisis of science. That intrigued me.
All right. Well, this is not... It's not exactly fringe thinking at this point to be criticizing the ivory towers of academic science. In fact, it has been picked up on quite a lot in the last several years. And you've seen headlines on it in the Washington Post and the Economist and the Times Higher Education Supplement and Scientific American and Nature and Phys.org and many other sites are talking about various problems in mainstream science, which were perhaps most notably flagged for the first, or not for the first time, but notably flagged in 2005 by a researcher. I don't want to get his name, the name, pronunciation of his name wrong, but I will anyways. John Ioannidis, who published an article in PLOS, which is one of the major science publication repositories, called "Why Most Published Research Findings Are False," in which he had the rather startling but undeniable fact that a lot of scientific material that is published is not reproducible and is in fact false. Now, this has been something that's been talked about and explored in various facets. It's not, it started out, it was essentially a critique of psychology and psychological studies, but this has since branched out. They've found these types of errors and biases and problems going on in economics and in medicine, in nutrition, all of these different, fields of science where there are some serious problems, and people are starting to identify some of the key structural issues that lead to the startling fact that 70% of researchers, according to Nature.com, had tried and failed to reproduce published experiments, and also showed that 40% of those researchers believed that fraud was always or often the inability to reproduce research. So there's scientists are basically blowing the whistle saying there's a lot of fraud going on. And why is that? Why is it happening? There are obviously incentives in place. When we see behavior like that happening, there are incentives in place to motivate people to act in that way. And there are a number of them that, again, are structural issues to the way that science is conducted right now. And one that I'm sure a lot of people have heard about, at least mentioned, is publish or perish. You have to publish papers in reputable journals and receive so many citations in order to essentially keep your cushy research jobs and keep the grant money flowing into your lab. And that has created a situation where people will do increasingly anything to get their studies published. And there's a lot of different ways that you can do that. Of course, the way to get a study published and to ensure that a study will get published is to have a sensational or remarkable finding. Now, of course, breakthrough findings in science don't exactly come along every day. So how do all these people vie? How do they wrangle and try to get their studies to show something surprising enough to get some attention, at least to show something surprising enough that the journal will be willing to publish it? And hey, if it also generates lots of headline articles in the mainstream media, then that will generate a lot of attention to your research, so much the better. Universities and labs love that, because then it'll get them more attention. So that's another aim. How do they go about doing this? There are a lot of different ways. One that's been talked about in recent years is p-hacking, which probably means nothing to everyday laymen, but is a type of statistical trick, essentially, to try to show something of statistical significance that may actually be completely irrelevant. So, I mean, there are any number of examples of how this is done and what kinds of things result from it, but one that I think most people can relate to is trying to follow nutritional guidance or nutritional advice, at least such that trickles down through the media. I mean, take, for example, coffee. You have undoubtedly heard it increases your chance of urinary tract cancer, or it decreases your chance of stroke, or, you know, take chocolate. Eating chocolate can make you live longer. Eating chocolate is terrible for your heart. Eating chocolate, no matter what it is, you have heard contradictory results in the span of your lifetime, I guarantee it, on all sorts of different foods. And that's one way that we see this playing out in the everyday media. But I think the most insidious part of this problem, what it really boils down to, is, yes, it is about essentially, I mean, these are people who are scientists that are trying to make their way in a career, and they're trying to get, obviously, prestige, but perhaps more importantly, grant money so that they can continue doing research. Where is that money coming from? Increasingly, that money is coming from the corporations that are dictating the ways in which this money is dispersed and what it will be spent looking into, and thus what the results of that research will be. And I talked about this recently on my program, where I was talking about Johnson & Johnson and their baby powder asbestos scandal, as reported on by Reuters last December, yes. Where they were talking about this problem that Johnson & Johnson have known about since the 1950s at this point, some of their key sources of baby powder were mixed in, the talcum was mixed in with asbestos, and they knew this internally, corporate-wise, and they were trying to look at ways to downplay this or distract people from it. And one of the things I talked about in that story was the Johnson & Johnson head researcher of their research department anonymously publishing and then reviewing a study about how, oh, it's no big deal. You see, the cancer rates are about the same in this control group as in that one, which was, of course, the whole point of the study. That's why Johnson & Johnson was doing this and trying to anonymously publish these studies and then cite them elsewhere. That's an example of how corporations can influence research, but there are many, many other examples possible. And then what's the alternative? Well, of course, the government can provide money, but, of course, that just leads to the creation of institutions like the Climate Research Unit at the University of East Anglia in England, which has been responsible for a lot of the climate change, you're killing the environment with your SUV kind of propaganda that we've seen over the last several years or decades at this point, and was infamously exposed during ClimateGate, where the internal emails of the CRU team came out, and lo and behold, it showed them fixing and fudging numbers and organizing amongst themselves to try to keep certain papers from being published and things like this, things that were didn't go along with the climate change alarmism. It was a huge scandal that ultimately got swept under the rug because of some whitewash commissions that were appointed to sweep it under the rug. But it's you can go and read in black and white the researchers' own emails and what they were doing, of course, in order to keep that money flowing. And that's, I think that's one of the things that this boils down to. We've been fed this idea that scientists are floating around on clouds and are so much above all of this, but essentially they are playing games that have been set up for them, and of course reveling in their sort of saint-like status in the scientistic society, where scientists are revered. Oh, these are the people who will tell us what's what about reality, and they have no biases, of which, of course, again, as we're finding out more and more, is absolutely 180 degrees from reality.
So the world in which we live is just, you know, it's really amazing, because people make decisions, their life decisions, on a lot of this information and things that are fed them, and you know, it's there's no accountability, and everybody knows this. Everybody accepts that there's 40% fraud, and yet what is ever being done? Because the money overpowers the need to hold anybody accountable.
Exactly right. And there are some ideas that are coming along that at least promise to be to open up the doors a little bit more, to allow the public sort of to see what's going on under the hood a little bit more, hopefully, which include the entire concept of open science, because as people may or may not know, the primary outlet for publication of respectable scientific research, of course, is through these publishers that publish these journals that are heavily gatekept for certain, you know, scientific dogma that must be adhered to and all of this, and it forms these cliques like what was exposed in ClimateGate. Well, the idea that, well, hey, we are living in the internet age, we can have a different way of doing this now. Now, instead of going through these publishers that then send out these papers to different reviewers to get their comments and then work the paper into some publishable form, da-da-da, well, in this day and age, it is certainly possible, and some people are trying out this concept of putting out preliminary research in ways that is open to comment, and not just open to comment within a certain closed clique of the scientific community that is allowed to, but really open to comment so that anyone, even a layman who was sufficiently interested and motivated, could provide feedback and criticism and point out flaws in the research and what's going on, so that it could take some form of shape or form that would be perhaps more responsive to reality, shall we say, and more responsive to criticism or charges of fraud. That's one example of the ways that the communication technology itself could change the way that we conceptualize what is the way that science is gatekept in our current day and age. And there are other ideas too, like a much simpler idea perhaps is the idea that, well, if people are motivated to publish because they must publish, then people may try to replicate a study. But why would they? Why would they try to replicate someone else's research? You're not going to publish your own journal study article saying, hey, look, I successfully published this research. Or even if you don't successfully replicate this research, even if you don't successfully replicate it, again, that's not going to get you your scientific name and fortune. So people are saying, well, maybe we should have journals of reproducibility. I was able to reproduce, or I was not able to reproduce this result. And that in itself could form a sort of incentive for people to actually try to replicate research, which is the theory upon which this is all working. Oh, you know, don't worry. Once a study has been published in Nature or whatever, don't worry. I'm sure, I mean, it could be replicated anytime, anywhere by anyone, and they'd find the same results because this is ironclad research. Well, no, they're going back and finding, you know, actually as much as half or even more of papers can't be reproduced, and you can't find the same results. So there's clearly a gaping problem in the system. Perhaps if we motivate people to try to reproduce results and find some way to incentivize that, that could be one way of putting in another check in the system.
So what you're saying is we should just ignore most any reports that come out by science.
We should certainly ignore the sensational, grabby headlines in the media, which are motivated by their own corporate slant for corporate advertising and what have you. And it's an insidious system that occasionally will get exposed, but generally decades too late. As people might have seen in the last few years, it came out, surprise, surprise, who would have thunk it, when the American... Oh, I don't know which. I don't know which particular branch of government it was that came out in 1980 with the dietary guidelines, you know, the food pyramid and all that. That was, of course, heavily influenced by various industries, nutritional industries that wanted you to essentially consume more sugar. And so they pumped this, oh, low-fat diet, so we got to take fat out. Well, you've either got fats, carbs, or proteins to play with, and protein energy content is about going to remain the same. So if you're reducing fat, you're going to have to increase carbs. And if you increase carbs, what's the easiest way to do that? Well, sugar. So, hey, great. It's great for the sugar industry and people who rely on it, like the soda companies and all of that. And now it turns out, oh, now they're coming out and saying, oh, you know what, that was completely a wrong turn, perhaps one of the worst turns in the history of medical science. We shouldn't have said that. In fact, you know, fat isn't an unmitigated evil, and in fact, carbs and sugar itself may in fact be a toxin, which we should try to avoid more. Oops, you know, sorry about that. And it's finally starting to come out, but along with that, a lot of the stories about how the sugar industry, essentially, and as I say, the associated industries, basically kept this under wraps for decades, even though they knew that this was causing the obesity epidemic that we've seen skyrocket since that food pyramid was introduced.
Yeah, it really is incredible. And again, the Overwatch. And how much of the internet? We're going to be heading into a break here shortly. How much is the internet that has that since 2000? And, you know, really since the year 2000, the increase of usage of the internet and people following these headlines and so forth. That has had to have some kind of a major impact.
It certainly has, and we can follow up on that after the break.
Okay, and we're heading into this break right now. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival. We'll be right back right after this short message.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com, or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today. today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231. And the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and I'm here with my guest, James Corbett of the Corbett Report. Please make sure you visit the website, thecorbettreport.com. And heading into the break, we were talking about the Internet and the impact that it has on these false scientific studies and how it has perhaps have made those studies grow over the years since the Internet has basically come into every home.
Yeah. Well, it's I think there's huge changes taking place in every facet of society because of these technological changes, and science is no different. And there's actually a really specific example with the thread that we could follow of someone who was heralded as this great matron saint of climate change researchers, Judith Curry, and she was working, I believe, at the University of Georgia. I don't remember which university at this point, but she was heralded as an expert on hurricanes and how extreme weather events might be affected by climate change, and she was highly cited until around the time of the ClimateGate scandal. She started a blog to basically go over issues and thoughts that she was having. So it's called Climate Etc., judithcurry.com. And she started to say, well, you know, some of these critics about what was happening at the Climate Research Unit and what's going on with this ClimateGate scandal, some of these critics have a point, and, you know, maybe we should listen to some of these ideas. And immediately the backlash started. Suddenly, Judith Curry, who had been hailed as this great researcher, was suddenly literally called a climate heretic and basically hounded because she just talked about not towing the line with regards to the dogma of the climate change hysterics. And as a result, over the last several years, her blog has become a valuable place for I don't want to say contrarianism, because that isn't it, but just alternative voices within the climate world, including, and we could point to a very specific example. Last October, there was this story about the oceans are heating up faster than expected because of new calculations. This new study that was published in Nature found that oceans were taking up 60% more heat than originally thought. That means that the Earth is actually warmer than we thought, and it's warming up quicker than we thought, and basically we're going to hell in a handbasket a lot sooner than we thought, and we have less time to save the world than we thought we did. It was this big scaremongering couple of weeks of this nonstop propaganda in all the usual outlets, CNN and Washington Post and what have you. And then on Judith Curry's blog, there was a researcher who had been invited to look at this new paper because he had some familiarity with the area, and he noticed on page one a basic mathematical error in this, again, published in Nature, the prestige journal. You know, they can't get higher than that in the scientific world. On page one, a basic mathematical error that completely threw their conclusion completely out the window. The study was essentially useless because they had made a basic error. And he pointed this out on Judith Curry's blog, to the point where the researchers had to go and say, oh, you know, sorry, Nature, but it looks like there's a mistake, and yeah, it means our study's useless. So amazingly, you can still go and get that study at nature.com. They didn't even retract it. They just put a little editor's note on it to say the researchers have informed us that there is an error that makes these conclusions untenable, blah, blah, blah. We'll assess the effect this has and update in the future, something along those lines. So they haven't retracted the paper. They haven't provided any updates, but basically, the study is bunk. All of those headlines that went out about how the oceans are heating faster and it's worse than we thought and all of this, of course, you know, everyone saw those headlines. No one saw the little correction that was that came out weeks later. And what was the BBC version of this? Climate change Concerns over report on ocean heating was the headline they went with. Whereas, of course, you know, 60% hotter oceans, the oceans are boiling, all of these scaremongering headlines. But when they come to issue the retraction, it's buried in the bottom of the science news feed on, you know, page 17 of the website, and it comes with this little concerns over report on ocean heating nonsense headline that tells you nothing about this basic mathematical error that completely changes the entire study.
It truly is amazing, isn't it? And no one's there to, and people don't look, people don't do their own reading, they just read headlines.
So I don't know if that's a hopeful story or not, because, hey, at least, you know, because of the internet and this open nature and this blog that publishes these things, this error was spotted and found and detected, mm-hmm. but then, how does that get propagated out to the media, and how do people consume that? Well, most people won't see that retraction. Most people will see the original headline, so is it a boon or not? I don't know.
Well, let's go into the topic of the State of the Union. We've just had that this week with President Trump, and certainly the media, and, you know, they've certainly have dragged that around enough times. So you caught something that you wanted to talk about.
Yes, yes. Well, I did pick up, obviously, on the headlines in the MAGA, you know, Donald Trump is the savior kind of press that said, oh, you know, look, you know, Trump is saying that America will never be a socialist country and all of this great rhetoric. Isn't this great? Well, you dig into the speech, and of course, it's all the usual stuff about, oh, mm-hmm. we need to go in and overthrow Maduro because he's an evil dictator, and we, the policemen of the world, get to tell people how to run their countries and blah, 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 that kind of stuff. Or, you know, we have to support Israel, so we have to get rid of Iran because they're the evil boogeyman, and that kind of stuff. And, oh, yeah, he says, you know, we will never be a socialist country. But the problem with that little theory is that America is a socialist country. It
yes,
already
we,
is. I
yes,
mean, to
we
be
are.
Fair, to be fair, every country is to some extent or other, because they all operate under this principle that there is a single central authority that gets to, at the very basic level, literally run the economy, because they literally print the money. They are monopoly capitalist control over the money. Monopoly capitalism, state capitalism, is socialism. That's what it is. It's control by a central crew. And basically, we're being offered national socialism versus international socialism, but people who want genuinely free markets and free from government intervention aren't ever going to see that in their lifetime unless there is a dramatic change in events and people stop accepting and swallowing this Kool-Aid from politicians who tell them, you know, we'll never be a socialist country. Meanwhile, the EPA is dictating what you can or cannot do with your business, and the FDA is dictating what you can or what drugs you can or cannot take, or what food you can put into your body, and every other, I mean, go through the list. The SEC is telling people, you know, how to run their businesses, even as they know about gaping backdoors in the software that they mandate for companies to use for their compliance, and I mean, you can go through the list, blah, 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 but yes, it is a socialist system. It is set up by a clique that essentially controls and regulates every aspect of the economy, everything that's going on. Yeah. That is socialism. So saying America will never be a socialist country and all these people standing up and applauding, yay, yay, you know, we'll never be a socialist, you already are. People realize that and realize what that means, they'll continue to swallow the Kool-Aid from politician after politician. And the next, whatever the next crusader and savior, political savior that comes along, they'll get behind as well. And until they stop and really realize what state capitalism is socialism.
Well, you're right. Something drastic is going to happen, and then even then, so I'm not quite sure they'd even recognize, you know, where we're exactly at. But, you know, one thing that I noticed in the State of the Union was he made a statement that he is meeting with North Korea, Kim Jong-un, on February 27th and 28th in Vietnam. Now, shortly thereafter, the next day, I saw there was a Michael Cohen, President Trump's so-called fixer, was originally scheduled to testify publicly in D.C., and then they changed it to a private testimony for, I think it was like February 12th, and now they changed that also February 28th at the same time that President Trump is meeting with the North Korean leader in Vietnam. Now, I know that might be just a coincidence, but, you know, I just can't leave it at that. Do you think there's, you know...
Yeah.
Does it mean anything, or is it
I don't want to misattribute this quote. I believe, I want to say it was FDR. I don't remember. But whoever it was, former president, said there are no coincidences in politics, or something to that effect. And, you know, for once, I think the president was right about something. Yes, there are no coincidences when it comes to these things. And it's, of course, if you are trying to undermine a president politically, and again, I'm not taking sides in this kind of stuff. It's just political distraction, you know, put out this puppet and make the public hate him or make the public love him. Either way, it's you're still looking at a puppet show. But, yes, within that system where, of course, you have the Dems and the Republicans, you know, arguing and bickering, of course, if you're trying to undermine the president politically, if there's a chance that he's going to get some kind of great photo op that'll look good and make him into a leader, well, then you do something on that same day that'll take the news coverage away from that. And, you know, it's not exactly rocket science.
Or could it be the other way around, is to take away the testimony of Michael Cohen because he goes to prison shortly thereafter. So.
Well, there you go. I mean, actually, yes. I don't know. Yeah, that's a good point. I don't know which date was set first. Yeah, so whatever way it is, it's, yeah, political puppeteering.
Abortion has been in our news lately, and I'm curious, what does the world, what does Japan and the world, how do they view abortion? I mean, is it as...
Well, that's a pretty broad topic. How does every human being on the planet...
I mean, is it... Well, let's just take Japan.
Yeah. That, you know, what are the actual laws? That's a very good question. When I think of this as a political issue, I think most recently about Ireland, which in the last couple of years, of course, had the big vote to basically approve abortion under certain circumstances in Ireland, which was a pretty big move for a staunchly Catholic country that had for very long opposed this practice. So that was a pretty big move. But again, it is country by country. But when we're talking about what is it, late third trimester, up to the point of dilation, maybe even actually delivering the baby and then having talks with the mother about whether or not it should be killed. That's, I mean, I don't think there's anyone alive who thinks that's a great idea that we definitely need. It's, there's an awful lot of controversy that surrounds it. But as crazy as that sounds, it's actually even worse because it was just a few years ago that people will always say, oh, you know, the slippery slope argument is nonsense and, oh, it's not like people are arguing for infanticide. Well, of course, a few years ago, they did have that I can't remember which... person was, but a large name in the field of bioethics, whatever that means, but who came out with a article about essentially infanticide, you know, post-delivery abortion, something along those lines. It may be feasible, or it might be advisable that we should start thinking about within the first 2 years of life before, you know, the baby really develops into a thinking human being, that maybe the mother should be allowed the option to continue to terminate the life, whatever they want to call it. It's murder, of course, at that point, but that is the argument that is now starting to be broached in the bioethics journals and elsewhere, and this is the way they introduce it to the public. Well, you know, we have late third trimester abortions that it might involve a delivery. We might have to commit the abortion after the delivery, which, of course, again, is just flat-out murder. But it's trying to change the rhetoric around this issue and soften the public, essentially, to be ready when these ideas start to be floated by the technocrats in power.
Is the U.S. leading the way?
It looks like it at this point. Certainly this type of... I haven't seen this type of discussion being discussed elsewhere, but, But then again, I mean, you think of, you know, the forced abortions and what have you in China, so, yeah, the technocrats perhaps vie with each other for who can be the most evil in their practices.
It's amazing. We wanted to get to your most recent article, Fake News and Economics Edition.
Yes.
And we have about 2 minutes.
Okay. Well, I mean, this stems from the news that came out in the past couple of weeks about Japan and is now going through its economic data and finding that 40% of the economic data that's issued by or relied on by the government for its various unemployment benefits and things like that, 40% of its economic data is bogus. Specifically, 22 of the 56 key economic stats reported by the government are faulty, and that, quote, irregularities in 21 of the 22 set violations of the statistics law. So this is a big scandal, and now it's becoming a political scandal, and they're basically, the opposition is saying this undermines the government's credibility and all of this. La-di-da. Well, yes, this is a scandal, but only because people aren't really aware of just how commonplace it is. In fact, every country on the planet cooks its books in one way or another, or does statistical fudgery to make things sound better when they need the public to be on their side. And China is a glaring example of that with its GDP fudgery and various examples that have come out in recent years. The governor of one of the provinces in China coming out and admitting that they made up economic data basically to receive bureaucratic handouts because they, you know, it's performance-based. So if your province is doing better, you'll get more handouts. Well, of course, we're going to make up the numbers. So they've come out and admitted that. There's a fake inflation data scandal that took place in Argentina in recent years. Fake economic data is in the news in India. There was that big scandal about Greece faking its way into the Eurozone with the help from Goldman Sachs a few years ago. Mm-hmm. But I use this basically as a way of introducing the reader to, who might not know about it, to the extraordinary new federal guidelines that the U.S. government introduced or is now operating on, and that were outlined in October of last year. Now the government is legally allowed to lie to the American public about their budgets in the name of national security. You have to read this story to get the full ramifications of that.
Only in America. Here we go. All right, I appreciate it. They've been doing it for such a long time. Now it's legal to do.
Now it's black and white and in law.
Yep.
Crazy.
And thank you, James, for joining us today. And I want to thank the listeners for joining us. And we'll be back. And be safe. Good night. And God bless. I have a friend. If I'm lucky, I will be.